vice chairman and in charge because the chairman claimed to have a bad cold that night, made an attempt to ease the tension in the room. "We are aware," he began, "that the majority of those present tonight are here about a zoning variance. I will remind you that it's the zoning board that has the authority for those decisions." "Why'd we elect you, then?" somebody shouted from the back row. "Yeah," somebody else loudly agreed. "The zoning board's appointed and you appointed them. We want accountability." In spite of Pete Hamrick's attempt to calm the waters by saying that the commissioners could offer only an airing of our differences, nobody believed him. So he opened the floor for discussion. It just about got out of hand. Those of us who wanted to speak had put our names on a list beforehand, but things got so rowdy that some were not called, and others who had not asked to speak stood up and spoke anyway. I had my statement written out, but was never able to get to the microphone, which was just as well, for I'd had my say at the intervention staged on my behalf, for all the good it had done. I had changed no one's mind then, and didn't expect to now. Sam spoke eloquently on the historic importance of the area in question, reminding the commissioners that some of the nearby houses were eligible to be on the historic register and deserved protection from inroads by incompatible entities. Binky nearly brought the house down when she pointed out that a change in the zoning of one stable neighborhood meant that no other neighborhood was safe. She was greeted by groans and calls of "not true" from a contingent of church members I didn't recognize, but by whom I was outraged at their lack of courtesy. Binky gave as good as she got, though, for she turned to the room and asked, "How many of you catcallers live under homeowners association covenants that protect you from this?" Pete Hamrick, looking a bit like a deer in the headlights, had to gavel the room to quiet. I held my breath when Mr. Pickens stood up and walked to the microphone, where a long-winded, repetitive speech on the need for public housing was being given by a slender, bearded man whose time had already been called. Others waited behind him, but he kept talking, accustomed, it seemed, to being given the floor whenever he wanted it. Mr. Pickens simply stood beside him, looked long and hard at him, and held out his hand. After a glance at Mr. Pickens's face, the bearded man stuttered, I yield to this gentleman here, and a few of us clapped. Hardly knowing how or what Mr. Pickens would say, I was both surprised and impressed when he presented his argument in a calm but forceful way, and the whole room quietened as he spoke. After introducing himself as one of those who would be most affected by a variance, he began telling them why. "Number one, the zoning board has confirmed that a group home is impermissible in its current location. In addition, the city attorney is authorized to close it down for noncompliance the minute it begins operating. So if the Board of Commissioners intends to override the zoning board, why do we have any zoning ordinances at all? Number two, Jackson Street, which runs in front of the Cochran property, is too narrow for the increase of traffic that a group home will create. We've already had to ask for no parking signs to be put up on one side of the street, yet two-way traffic is still difficult to maneuver. Number three, there is not enough on-site parking on the property in question. Two cars are all that the driveway will accommodate, one of which will belong to the house parents. All other cars will have to be parked on the street, taking up spaces in front of neighboring houses. Number four, the house in question has three bedrooms and two baths. Yet we have it on good authority that they're taking in 7 teenagers and 2 house parents. They'll have to either cram 9 people into bunk beds or put pallets on the floor. And 9 people plus the number of visitors in the form of counselors, tutors, family members, and friends using the bathrooms, it will result in a steady strain on an antiquated sewer system. As the next door neighbor, I can testify to the likelihood of tree root encroachment in the sewer line. I've already had to replace mine to the tune of several thousand dollars. Number five, considering the number of people that will be living there, our quiet residential neighborhood will suffer an increase in noise. Talking, shouting, slamming of car and house doors, music or what passes for music, and screeching of tires. Number six, The word is out that there is a plan behind the plan for a group home, that a certain corporation has its eye on our entire block, and that the request for this variance is just the opening move for a complete rezoning of the area. If you are aware of such a plan, it's incumbent on you to disclose it. This caused a stir among the listeners, as people looked at one another wondering what he meant. One of the commissioners, I couldn't see who it was, said, "Stick to the subject." Mr. Pickens replied, "That's what I'm doing. So to sum up, with the number of cars going and coming and blocking driveways, the lack of parking space on the property itself, as well as on the street, the overcrowding in the house which creates a fire hazard, the resulting overuse of the sewer system, and the possibility of being rezoned commercial or worse, I suggest with respect that instead of overruling the zoning board and granting a variance for the homes for teens, the Board of Commissioners denies that request and declares the proposed use of the Cochran House a public nuisance." He turned and walked back to his seat beside Hazel Marie, whose face couldn't have expressed more pride in her husband. I thought that some of the rude, outspoken people who had already raised their voices in protest would do the same to Mr. Pickens, but nobody did. Instead, the room remained quiet, subdued, in fact, until one after another those in favor of granting the variance gathered their courage and spoke, either angrily denouncing anyone who would deny a child a roof over its head, or sobbing, as one woman did, because heathens were hindering the work of the Lord. My land, if I hadn't known better, I'd have thought that those opposed, which included me, were the most hard-hearted, selfish, even demented people on earth. Shivering in my heavy coat as the car heated up, I was quiet as we drove away. But Sam wasn't. He sneezed all the way home. "Are you getting sick?" I asked, searching for a Kleenex in my pocketbook.
"Might be," he said, sniffing. "My head feels like it's about to explode."
"Well, so does mine, but not because of a cold coming on. I just couldn't believe some of those people. The whole thing was like being in a room with Madge multiplied." Sam laughed, then sneezed again.
"Pickens did well, didn't he?"
"Yes, he did. I didn't know he had it in him to control his temper as he did." Glancing at him, I went on, "There's some Robitussin in the medicine cabinet." He turned into our driveway, then said,
"I don't need cough medicine, but an aspirin or two might help."
When we got inside and had divested ourselves of scarves and coats, Sam said,
"Well, what did you think?"
"I've been waiting for you to tell me. What really happened in there?" After hearing from more people than had signed up to speak, Pete Hamrick had called for a motion to delay a decision on the Cochran House, not only until the commission had a full contingent, but also until they could consult with the zoning board. To the many shouts of disapproval, a motion was quickly made and seconded, and the commissioners had all but run from the room.
"My bet," Sam said, "is that they'll go into a closed session, make their decision, and blame whatever it is on the zoning board. Then they'll bury it among other things on the agenda in a small announcement in the newspaper. Whatever they decide, they'll get some blowback, which is probably why the chairman wasn't there."
"Well, I wish they'd voted tonight, because if they approve the variance, Mildred and I have plans of our own." Sam smiled.
"Care to tell me what they are?"
Then he had another sneezing fit. "You go take some aspirin while I fix you some hot tea with honey. Then you're going to bed, and I won't be far behind."
"Okay, but tell me what you and Mildred are up to."
"All right, but don't tell anybody. If the vote goes against us, we're thinking of forming a holding company, or..." I stopped and reconsidered. "Or we'll just do it on our own. But somebody needs to outbid whoever is buying the other houses. You know, the Pickrells and the Osborne house, and you may not know this, but the Winsteads have caved because Marie Winstead said she'd cleaned that huge house for the last time, and she was moving to a townhouse with or without Hal. So that means that we have to step in right away before their closing dates. That's why we're so anxious about what the commissioners will do. But I'll tell you this, Sam. The fact that they didn't make a decision tonight does not bode well for us.
But what?
Sam asked.
Would you and Mildred do with 3 empty houses?
We just figure that if that property is so valuable to a secret buyer, then it ought to be valuable to us as well.
My word, Julia,
Sam said, staring at me.
Do you two know what you could be getting into?
Well, no, but that's never stopped us before.
But, honey, you'll still have the homes for teens to deal with.
I know, but if the commissioners grant a variance for them, then that opens the door for another one. We haven't yet decided what we'll do, but it'll be something that Madge and her crew will not like. Sam's eyes rolled back in his head. Then he sneezed again.
And have you figured out what you'll do when you run afoul of J.D. Pickens?
Well, not yet. But if we're able to run Madge off, which is what we hope to do, I figure he'll thank us in the long run. Chapter 41. I knew it, I said, slapping the newspaper down on the table, just missing the cup of coffee that Lillian had snipped in front of me. Sam had handed the paper to me, folded to the small article at the bottom of the front page as soon as I'd come to the breakfast table. At least, I went on, my heart filling with disappointment, I should have known it when the commissioner stopped the proceedings the other night without a vote. They didn't have the courage to vote in public. They probably hoped we wouldn't notice it in the paper, and I snatched up the paper and scanned the article. Did you see this? Sam, the vote was 5-0. Every last one of them voted to grant the variance. I can't believe this. Not a one of them has a grain of sense. Lillian, between wild swings of my arms, slid a plate of eggs and bacon before me, then quickly stepped back.
Well, now, hold on, honey,
Sam said, his voice hoarse with whatever he'd come down with.
Look, they didn't actually grant the variance that was asked for. What they did was grant a conditional use permit.
Which means what?
Well, it allows an otherwise non-permitted use of a property, a use that's not covered by the zoning laws.
That sounds like a variance to me.
No,
Sam said, a far-off thinking look on his face.
Actually, it opens the door to a wider use than a specific variance would have. Just what I was afraid they'd do. I'd have to see exactly how it's worded, but it could cover the entire block.
See, Julia, he said, turning to look directly at me.
A conditional use permit is based on the commissioner's determination that the new use would be in the public interest.
I expect, I said with some bitterness, that Madge could make a case that providing a home for homeless children is in the public interest.
I'm sure she could. But don't you see, there are a lot of other things that could be described as in the public interest as well. Think about it, honey. That block could accommodate a county office building, a strip mall, a school, an auditorium for cultural events. I could think of a number of things that the commissioners could defend as being better for the town than individual ownership of a few houses.
Oh, my word, I said, the possibilities multiplying in my mind. That sounds like a government takeover of the entire block. Is that what's going on?
No, it's not an eminent domain situation, at least not yet. But it does seem that those ridgetop people have more in mind than one little house for a non-profit organization.
But, Sam, even if they do have more in mind, what about the Pickenses? They'll still have to be dealt with. They'll still be a holdup.
Not, he said darkly, if their property is condemned as standing in the way of the public interest.
I jumped straight up from my chair, startling Lillian, who was approaching with the coffee pot. I've got to talk to Mildred. And with a swirl of my bathrobe, off I went, leaving eggs cooling on my plate and coffee doing the same in my cup.
Okay, Mildred said after I'd explained what Sam had said about a conditional use permit. Then we have to get in and do our thing right away. But if the Pickrells, the Winsteads, and Jan Osborne will accept, say, 5 to 10,000 above what they've been offered, we'll still have Madge's group home sitting right where it is, right?
That's right, I said, nodding even though she couldn't see me, because neither Madge nor her board owns it. Ridgetop Corporation is listed as the owner, and I'll bet you money that it's this Ridgetop group that's trying to buy the rest of the block. But if we buy those properties out from under them, all they'd have would be the Cochrane House. And what would they do with that? Listen, Mildred, I went on. The way it looks to me is this. Ridgetop wants the whole block, and Madge's group was put there to make the homeowners willing, even eager, to sell. But if our plan works and we buy the other houses, Ridgetop will dump the Cochrane House as fast as they can and move on to something else.
I get that, Mildred said, but what if they don't? We could be left with a group home in the middle of our property, still owned by Ridgetop. What if they get mad enough to hold on to it just to get back at us?
No. I think once we foil their grand scheme, they'll be glad to get rid of it. We're dealing with business people, Mildred, as you keep reminding me, and they know how to separate the emotional from the financial. At least I hope they do.
We were both silent for a few minutes, thinking over what the Ridgetop people might do.
Well, Mildred said, if they decide to hold on to that one house, we could do something on the rest of the block that would encourage the homes for teens to move, which would leave them with an empty house.
Maybe, I said dubiously, but Madge is pretty much set in concrete.
I don't know about that, Mildred said. All we'd have to do would be to demolish the Pickerel and the Osborne houses. I drove past them the other day, and Julia, they're hardly worth trying to restore. The Winstead house, though, probably has some historic value and should be saved. Still, with two houses gone, there's enough room on the block for a wonderful new use that could qualify as being in the public interest, and it would, without a doubt, encourage the group home to move.
Like what?
I'm thinking, Mildred said, that a petting zoo would do the trick, with free petting tours for every elementary school child in the county, making it qualify as being in the public interest. Think of little calves and goats and llamas and sheep and a couple of mules, along with a few Shetland ponies, maybe a camel or two. Think, Julia, of the baying, lowing, and neighing, to say nothing of the aromas that would waft over the landscape.
Mildred, I said, laughing in spite of myself, you have an evil mind.
Accustomed as I was to Mildred's flights of fancy, I gave little credence to her suggestion of a petting zoo. For one thing, Madge and her crowd would not be the only ones affected. Mildred knew as well as I did that Mr. Pickens wouldn't stand for such a thing. He might organize a wholesale roundup. But she quickly got down to business, telling me that her Atlanta attorneys were sending one of their real estate lawyers to represent us in slipping in behind the Ridgetop people and buying up the block we wanted.
Their advice, she said, is to form a real estate holding company which would be the actual owner of what we buy. It'll have tax and liability benefits as well, but the big thing now is to come up with a name so they can draw up the papers. What do you want to call it?
I don't know. I'm still coming to terms with the term liability.
She laughed.
It'll protect us from liability, Julia. Don't worry. I'm paying people to look after us. Think up a name.
I don't know, I said again. How about M and J for Mildred and Julia, or just MJ. Or we could go with last names and do A and M for Alan and Murdoch. I got good with names.
Well, you're not very original, that's for sure. But listen, we don't want people being able to guess who we are. I was thinking of something like Great Dane Properties or some such. That's not bad, I said, thinking of a neat logo for our enterprise. And it'll provide a little misdirection, too. People will think it's Mr. Pickens or Thurlow, since Ronnie's the only Great Dane around, but they'd hesitate to tackle either one of them.
Just so they don't think we're an offshoot of Greyhound bus lines, Mildred said with a laugh. Anyway, go ahead and start converting to cash, because I'm instructing our agent to offer cash sales with immediate closing dates. We don't want Ridgetop to come back in and top our offers. In fact, I want to get it done before they realize we're nipping at their heels.
But, I said, another worry popping up, what if the homeowners feel obligated to Ridgetop? They've already accepted their offers.
Julia, Mildred said firmly, this is business. More money tops less money, and Ridgetop has for some reason delayed closing on those houses. Waiting, I guess, the usual 30 days, and probably to make sure they'll get their variance as well. They'll get their earnest money back, so all they'll be losing is the fruition of their grand scheme, whatever it is. By the way, she went on, are you going to Sue's tonight?
I don't think so. Was I supposed to?
I'm sure you were. She's trying to get some Christmas ornaments made for a couple of nursing homes.
Oh, my goodness, I'd forgotten about that. Since they've stopped doing the Christmas fair, I haven't given making ornaments another thought.
I stopped and gave it a thoughtful moment. I guess I should go. But I expect Luann will be there, and I'm not sure I could keep from wringing her neck. I laughed then, realizing that I'd almost put that agonizing evisceration called an intervention out of my mind. I'd pretty much consigned it to the consider the source category.
Well, almost anyway. Every once in a while I'd get a flashback of Lynette's earnest face, or Madge's authoritative voice, or the self-righteous assumption of them all that I needed correction and that they were the ones qualified to administer it. The insolent pride it had taken to sit in judgment on me, on anybody for that matter, was staggering. So, no, I had not entirely gotten over it. So I sat down and wrote another note to Helen, telling her that I now fully understood how she felt and that I bitterly regretted my part in offering any kind of criticism of her use of Thurlow's funds, which, I assured her, was the business of the two of them and no one else. Having been put in the same position in which I'd helped put her, I wrote, I now humbly begged for her forgiveness. And after signing my name, I felt a whole lot better. Humbling oneself when needed does wonders for the soul and quietens the conscience as well. But whether it would make Helen rethink her offer of Thurlow's house for the Homes for Teens fundraiser, I didn't know. Maybe she wouldn't be finished with her decorating. Painters can be slow, to say nothing of back orders of fabric and wallpaper. It was entirely possible that she'd have to cancel the appearance of Thurlow's house on the house tour. One could only hope. I spent the afternoon worrying over Sam, who was now racked by a horrendous cough. Urging him to go to bed, I plied him with liquids and aspirin and suggested calling the doctor.
"It's just a cold, honey," Sam said. "It'll run its course in a day or so."
"Lillian," I said, turning to her, "do you know where we stored the humidifier? Steam is what he needs."
"What he need," Lillian said with the authority of one who knows, "is Vicks VapoRub and a hot flannel cloth on his chest."
"Well, for goodness sake, there was neither a jar of Vicks nor a piece of flannel in the house. Nor, as it turned out, a humidifier, having been discarded years before when it had sprung a leak. So I went to the drugstore and got what we needed, then had to listen to Sam moan about reeking of Vicks."
Chapter 42.
Hesitant about leaving Sam to struggle alone with his cold, I nonetheless prepared to go out into the night to make Christmas ornaments.
After pulling a thick sweater over my head, I had to redo my hair, apply a little color to my face, and use almost the last few drops of precious perfume before feeling ready to face another group of women. It was like putting on a coat of armor in case of an attack. I had at first decided to forego the drive to Sue's, and what might turn out to be another surprise to my system, especially after Mildred said it was too cold for man nor beast or her. But Sue had called, urging me to come, and Sam, for some reason, had urged me to go. He was propped up in our bed against a number of pillows with blanket and comforter tucked over and around him, books and magazines spread out on the bed, a tray of tempting liquids and curative medications on the bedside table, the humidifier steaming up the room, the television on, and the remote at hand.
"What more could I want?" he asked, indicating it all with a wave of his arm.
"Well, you might need something."
"Then I'll get up and get it. Go on, Julia. Enjoy yourself. I'll be fine."
So I went, but I didn't much enjoy it. Sue had all the felt, rick-rack, sequins, glue, and you name it needed to make ornaments for decorating Christmas trees at the chosen nursing homes. Plying a yarn-threaded needle to sew two halves of a star together, I sat at her dining room table along with Rebecca, Emma Sue, Callie, and Sue. Noting with relief that neither Luann nor Helen was there, I wondered if it was because I was. If they were avoiding me, I determined I would not let it bother me. But of course it did. Until something came up that bothered me even more. No one had said anything about our reduced number, although Sue commented on how busy everyone was and left it at that. In fact, hardly anyone had anything at all to say, seemingly engrossed with the work at hand. It wasn't until Callie asked what I'd thought about the commissioner's meeting that the conversation took on a life of its own. Answering carefully, I said, "I was disappointed that they didn't have the courage to vote publicly. But I guess that was too much to ask." "Well," Callie said, "I knew before I left what they were going to do. While everybody was milling around, I went down the hall to the restroom and passed a room where the commissioners were putting on their coats. They were standing around talking in sort of an impromptu closed session, except it wasn't so closed because the door was partly open. So I listened." "That's eavesdropping, Callie," Rebecca said with a note of rebuke. "No, it wasn't. If they'd wanted to keep it secret, they should have shut the door. Anyway, Pete Hamrick was really holding forth about the number of people who'd been there and about how they couldn't be expected to make a judgment with everybody and his brother criticizing everything they did. Then," Callie went on with emphasis, "he told them, and I heard this as plain as day, that they'd better not get cold feet because," he said, "there are always some people against progressive ideas." Then he said something about their having the authority to override the zoning board, and they'd better stick to their promise when the time came. "And," she concluded, "according to the newspaper, it looks like they did." My heart sank, as what I thought was going on had indeed been going on. I did, however, hold my peace, not wanting to air my concerns with those who were hardly affected by Madge's invasion of a neighborhood. I was surprised, though, when Sue said, "I thought there was something fishy about it from the start, and that just proves it." "I figured it was, too," Rebecca said. "Pete Hamrick has been in the library almost every week since all this started, looking at law books and historic records and books on upgrading small towns. I know," she went on, "because he came to the reference desk and asked for help to find what he wanted. I guess," she said with a wry twist of her mouth, "he thought that reference librarians were so wrapped up with Dewey Decimal numbers they couldn't put two and two together." "Well," Emma Sue said, "just don't get crosswise of him. You know, I'm not one to talk about people. But I've heard he has a one-track mind when he wants something. He can be very nice, but he'll run over you if you're in his way. But," she cautioned,
I did not hear that from Larry, who would never compromise the sanctity of the pastor's study.
She stopped and primly nodded her head.
I heard it at the beauty shop, which means that it wasn't privileged information.
Feeling that I was among sympathetic friends, I was tempted to release some of my outrage at both Madge's high-handedness and the commissioner's underhandedness. I was afraid, though, that once I started, I might also reveal the hand that Mildred and I were about to deal to those who thought they'd already won the pot. I've never played poker, but I know the vocabulary, and I'm not unfamiliar with high-stakes games. So I bit my lip and pondered this new information. Studying on what had been said as I drove the empty streets toward home about 10:30 that cold December night, I couldn't wait to tell both Sam and Mildred what Callie had overheard, and to tell them what Emma Sue had said about Pete Hamrick, who now seemed up to his neck in monkey business as well as commissioner's business. The decision to grant a zoning variance, even though disguised as a conditional use permit, had apparently been cut and dried before Pete Hamrick had banged down the opening gavel. And furthermore, Madge had known there'd be no problem before she'd first put a foot in the Cochran house. I'd call that public corruption, wouldn't you? Driving slowly toward home, going in and out of spots of light from the street lamps, I turned with no particular aim in mind onto Jackson Street, just taking the long way home. A few cars were parked along one side, but no one was out in the bitterly cold night. I had the long, straight, tree-lined street all to myself. As I approached the Pickens house from a few blocks away, I noted that the first floor was dark while the upstairs lights were on. They were getting ready for bed. I smiled then as I thought of Lloyd. He was back with his mother and Mr. Pickens, so he wouldn't catch Sam's cold, and I pictured him now reading or working at the computer, preparing for his classes. Then my eyes lit on Mr. Pickens's fence, and my smile turned grim. Why, I wondered for the 100th time, couldn't Madge have found a more suitable place to do her good works? Taking in the Cochran house beyond the fence, I saw that lights were on in the front room, but the porch was dark. Somebody had failed to replace a light bulb. It was a little late for any of the good ladies to be working in the empty house, so I thought it likely that lights had been left on in the front room on purpose. Maybe, I thought. Madge wanted to discourage visits like the one we'd had by making it look as if someone was in residence. And perhaps someone was, for one car was parked in the driveway. Slowly, before coming abreast of the Pickens house, my attention was drawn by a car turning on to Jackson a few blocks in front of me. Watching through the windshield as it approached on the narrow street, I saw it swing into a space directly in front of the Cochran house. A man jumped out from behind the wheel and, hunched over in a dark overcoat, hurried up the walk to the porch. Intrigued by a seemingly late-night rendezvous, I pulled to the side of the street and watched as the front door opened and the man slipped inside. Now, what was that about? Huddled over the steering wheel while appreciating the warmth of the heated seat, I knew I couldn't linger with lights on and motor running. I had to either go on home or turn everything off and freeze half to death while waiting to see what would happen next. Well, never one to just wait it out. I drove on past the Cochran house and turned onto the side street beside Jan Osborne's house at the end of the block. After parking, I buttoned my coat up to my neck, pulled on my gloves, and hid my pocketbook under the seat. Feeling safe enough to cross the Osborne's yard, the house was dark, I hurried toward Mr. Pickens's extended fence, edged onto the sidewalk to get around it, and crept toward a privet bush beside the front porch of the Cochran house. All I wanted to do was see who was meeting at such an odd hour and why the man had seemed in such a hurry. My chosen bush, though, was on the opposite side from the lit-up living room, so I carefully picked my way to the back of the house, stooping over as I passed the small, dark kitchen windows, and slid along the opposite side toward the front porch until I got to a lighted window, which was no help at all, for the blinds were closed. The only thing to do, because I'd come that far, was to hunker down between a large holly bush and the corner of the porch. I couldn't see a thing, and I couldn't hear a thing, but I'd be able to do both when the man decided to leave. The front door would open, spilling light onto the porch, and with luck, there would be a few words between him and whoever he'd been meeting. But, oh, how much better it would have been if I'd been scrunched down to watch and wait in July instead of December. Huddled in my coat, shivering in the cold, I found reason to appreciate Mr. Pickens's 6-foot-high fence. It was a shield from any sharp eyes peering from his windows. The night was still and quiet as I crouched between the cold stucco of the house and the needle-edged leaves of the holly bush. I pressed my ear against the wall to catch any stray words from inside when two sharp, sudden noises jolted the silent night, one in front of and one behind me. Startled, I cringed back as the front door of the Cochran house swung open not 4 feet from where I was squatting, just as the back door of the Pickens house banged open and yard lights flared on with Lloyd calling, "Wait, Ronnie!" Hoping that Ronnie would do his business on the other side of the fence and forget about taking up guard at the corner, I kept my attention on who was stepping out onto the porch. And like Callie, I couldn't help but overhear what was said. A woman's voice issued from the doorway, saying, "Don't you know how hard we've worked? You can't do this to us." "Can and will, Madge," the man said, his words muffled by a scarf, but clear enough. "You've got 6 months to a year, but after that you're out. Just be glad I'm giving you a warning." He turned to leave, and as I ducked back behind the corner, Madge, for that's who it was, called out, "But it's not fair, Pete. You rented it to us." Pete Hamrick, now identified, chuckled and said, "Check your lease." Then he started down the porch steps toward his car. Just then, Ronnie appeared at the corner of the yard, right at the end of Mr. Pickens's fence, as I knew he was wont to do, and set up a howl that could have wakened the dead. I could see his silhouette against the yard lights, his head thrown back, his neck stretched out, as deep baying sounds rolled from his throat and echoed around the neighborhood. Chills from more than the cold ran up and down my back from the mournful howling. Lloyd came running, calling, "Hush, Ronnie, hush! Come on, boy, you'll wake the whole town." Pete Hamrick, his shoulders hunched in his coat, scurried to his car, cranked it, and got out of there. Madge stood for a minute in the light of the door. Then she muttered, "Run, you lily-livered coward!" Afraid to move an inch for fear that Lloyd would notice a trembling holly bush, I watched through the leaves as the boy tried to coax Ronnie away from the edge of the yard. He pulled on the great dog's collar, but couldn't budge him until finally Ronnie paused for breath. In the brief, blessed silence, Madge called out, "Next time, sick that dog on him!" Then, turning with what sounded like a sob, she went inside, slamming the door behind her. Still crouching by the porch, I didn't know whether to reveal myself to Lloyd or to Madge or to creep away to my car and pretend I'd never been there. In reality, I didn't have much of a choice. I think my knees had locked or frozen in place from scooching down for so long. I couldn't even stand up. The choice came down to a toss-up between crawling across the yard or staying in a crouch for the rest of the night.
Chapter 43.
And Ronnie, having caught his breath, changed his tune and began barking and prancing around, twirling with excitement as he tried to pull away from Lloyd. He'd chased off one interloper and, to his delight, had picked up the scent of another one. Hoping to hide, I buried my face in the upturned collar of my coat and got a heady whiff of Chanel No. 5, Ronnie's scent of choice. Then another voice joined the racket. "Lloyd," Mr. Pickens called from the back door. Get that dog inside.
I'm trying my best, Lloyd called back. He won't come.
Then come get the leash.
Turning, Lloyd released Ronnie's collar and dashed toward the Pickens house to get the leash, and Ronnie, lured by the aroma of French parfum, dashed toward the Cochran house to get me.
He's gone, Lloyd yelled. J.D., he went next door.
Hold on, Mr. Pickens sang out. Let me get my...
gun?
I exploded out of that holly bush like a shot, locked limbs or no locked limbs, and ran for my life, or rather for my car.
Shoes on.
Shoes? Gun? It didn't matter. I ran. Just as I rounded the far fence to cross Jan Osborne's yard, Ronnie caught up with me and, tongue dangling, began loping happily alongside. Panting, I reached the car, flung open the door, and fell inside, then had to shove Ronnie away as he tried to crawl in over me. With a great bodily heave, I finally pushed him out and got the door closed. With Lloyd and Mr. Pickens still calling and whistling for him, Ronnie reared up against the car, his paws on the roof, and his great head pressed against the window as he peered longingly in at me. I cranked the car, eased away an inch or two, and Ronnie swung away to let me go. Fearing that he'd chase the car, I was relieved when he heeded Mr. Pickens's call and bounded away toward the man to whom he'd switched his allegiance. Fearing also that Lloyd or Mr. Pickens would identify my car, I left the headlights off until I turned a corner at the end of the street. Then I drove straight home, parked in the driveway, and tried to pull myself together. I'd just suffered a harrowing yet informative experience and didn't know whether to laugh or cry. But I now knew for a certainty that Madge and at least one county commissioner had been in cahoots all along, just as she'd implied, although there was no telling exactly what had transpired between them while I'd been cowering in a holly bush. All I knew was that a notice seemed to have been issued by one to the other, and Madge was none too happy about it. Waiting in the car until I'd settled myself down to some extent, I eventually eased into the house, locked the kitchen door behind me, and hoped that Sam was sleeping the sleep of the just. I took off my coat, then had to pick off the sharp-edged holly leaves that had come home with me. After hanging the coat in the pantry, I turned off the downstairs lights and got ready to face the music upstairs.
"Julia,"
Sam called as I trudged up the steps.
"Is that you?"
"You better hope so,"
I called back lightly, knowing he would laugh and perhaps not question me too closely.
"How are you feeling?"
I asked, entering and sitting on the bed beside him.
"Much better," he said,
then paused for a racking cough.
"I think I slept for a couple of hours. What time is it, anyway?"
"Not too late. We got a lot of ornaments made, but we talked a lot, too. Listen, Sam," I went on, distracting him from the question of time, "you won't believe what Callie overheard at the commissioner's meeting the other night."
I went on to repeat what I'd heard, ending by saying,
"We were right all along. It's been rigged from the start. The only thing we don't know is why. It obviously has something to do with buying up the rest of the block, but why do they want that? And exactly who are they? I mean, I guess they are Ridgetop, but who are they?"
"Good questions,"
Sam said, and coughed again.
"Here, drink this."
I poured a dose of Robitussin and handed it to him.
"I've a good mind to go see Madge Taylor. She may be in the right frame of mind to unload everything she knows." "Why would you think that? Nothing's really changed."
Well, I guess because things may be coming to a head or maybe to an end. I mean, with the commissioners having voted to let her stay there, which is essentially what that conditional use permit allows her to do."
Retreating quickly before I let on that I knew more than what Callie had overheard, Sam wouldn't approve of housecreeping. I veered to a related subject. "Rebecca said that Pete Hamrick has been in the library looking at historic records and books having to do with upgrading, modernizing, I guess, small towns. So he's up to his neck in whatever's going on."
"Oh, I wouldn't doubt it. He's into a lot of things anyway. But it's too late to worry about it tonight.
Come on to bed, honey.
I think I will, I said, beginning to rise.
Wait,
Sam said, frowning as he looked at me.
How'd you get that scratch on your cheek?
Oh, I said, frantically trying to think of a reason without out-and-out lying. I guess, well, I got too close to a holly bush as I was leaving Sue's and sort of brushed against it. Scratched my hand, too. I held up my hand to show him the stinging scratch across the back of it.
You need to be careful, Sam said. Both of us do. We're at the falling stage, and neither of us wants a broken hip.
You're right about that, I agreed, then went to the bathroom to look for the Neosporin. I lay in bed listening to Sam breathe through chest rattles and realized with a jolt of concern that I had more to worry about than zoning laws, block takeovers, or lapsed leases. First thing in the morning, I was taking him to Dr. Hargrove. When Sam turned onto his side, though, he began to breathe easier, and the same old concerns with a new twist invaded my thoughts. Pete Hamrick had thrown out the word lease to Madge. Check your lease, he'd said, and laughed as if he knew something she didn't. Was there something in the fine print that she'd overlooked? Maybe something in print so fine that it was meant to be overlooked. Maybe it had to do with the term of the lease, or maybe it didn't address options to renew. Or, and with this thought, I popped straight up in bed. Was there no lease at all? Had Madge, in her eagerness to lay hold of the house, moved in as Luann had moved into Helen's condo, without the protection of a lease? Which would mean that Madge and her merry band could be moved out at the whim of the owners, Pete Hamrick being apparently one of them. His last-minute jab to check her lease could have been a double-edged sword if there was no lease to check. Okay, I thought, lying back down. What do we really know at this point? Number one, Madge had known from the start that her non-profit undertaking was safe from the zoning board. That was now confirmed by the conditional use permit that Pete Hamrick had arm-twisted the Board of Commissioners into granting. Number two, a holding company by the name of Ridgetop Corporation was attempting to buy the other houses on the block. Pete's showing up at the Cochran house in the dead of night to warn Madge of an impending change in her status as a renter confirmed him as a member of that group. Only an insider would know something like that. Number three. Pete Hamrick, from what I'd overheard that night, was unaware, so far, that plans were afoot to outbid Ridgetop's offers to purchase. It was obvious to me that a lot of money was being staked on not just the Cochran house, but the entire block. What would he do when he learned that Mildred and I were cutting him off at the knees? Number four. And what would Madge do now that she knew Pete's plan to evict her? What would she do when she learned that Mildred and I would do the same as soon as we could? Madge had to know that she wasn't wanted where she was, so it hardly come as a surprise. She had done nothing but sneak around and ensconce herself in the Cochran house, then justified being there as her right. It seemed equally just to me that others would make a few stealthy moves to unensconce her. Then I mentally summed up with number five. She would need another place to house her homeless teens. And with that obvious conclusion in mind, I turned over and fell asleep in spite of Sam's full-bore snoring by this time. Chapter 44 Sam absolutely refused to go see Dr. Hargrove, or rather to go so Dr. Hargrove could see him. He came to the breakfast table fully dressed, freshly shaven, and looking only half-peaked. "I'm 100% better," he said, then coughed for several seconds. "Well," he grinned when he'd caught his breath, "maybe 90%. "All right," I reluctantly concurred, "but I'm watching you. At the first sign of a relapse, you're going to the doctor or the emergency room. Take your pick."
"Yes, ma'am."
"Lillian," he said, turning to her, "I attribute my return to health to your recommendation of Vicks VapoRub.
The next time I come down with something, I'm checking with you first.
She smiled, pleased with herself, and said,
Old Tommy Cures pretty much work every time.
We all turned as Lloyd rapped on the back door, then walked in.
Hey, everybody. I came over to tell you about the excitement we had last night. Boy, something was really going on at the Cochran house.
I quickly intervened. Have you had breakfast? Come sit with us, Lillian. Bring another plate, please.
Lloyd slid into a chair across from me.
I guess I could eat a biscuit or two. Nobody makes them like Miss Lillian.
The day was certainly starting off right for Lillian with all the compliments she was getting, and deservedly getting, I thought to myself, and tried to think of a few more to keep the subject on her rather than on Lloyd's news.
So what happened last night? Sam asked to my dismay.
Well, Lloyd said, his face lighting up with the telling, when I took Ronnie out about 11, he went crazy, and I mean crazy. See, there was somebody visiting next door at the Cochran house. I saw him when he left, and of course that set Ronnie off because he always barks when anybody goes or comes over there.
Who was it? I asked, as if I didn't know.
Not that it matters, but that time of night, who'd be visiting then?
I don't know. I was too busy trying to calm Ronnie down to see who it was, but it was a man, and he practically ran to his car and left in a hurry. But the funny thing about it was that Ronnie kept on carrying on, and always before, he'd stop barking when they left. But then he got away from me, and J.D. had to come out and help me chase him down. I can't figure out why Ronnie took off like that. He's never done that before either. I still can't understand it.
Of course I understood it.
Ronnie was partial to French perfume.
But Lillian, who was standing stock still beside the table, listening to this recital, gasped.
You mean he run away?
Oh, he came back. But we heard a car crank up down the street, and J.D. is convinced that Ronnie chased off a prowler. Or something worse. And J.D. gave him an extra treat last night and one this morning, too.
Oh, my goodness, I said, patting my chest. A prowler? That's scary, Lloyd, but I'm so glad it wasn't anything worse, and so glad that Ronnie was on guard duty. We'll have to tell Mr. Thurlow that Ronnie is a hero.
It was all I could do to keep from revealing my relief that even though I'd been smelled, I'd not been seen. But I've managed fairly well. At least nobody accused me of anything. Not even Lillian, who could usually tell when I'd been up to something.
It being a Saturday morning with no school, Sam invited Lloyd to go downtown with him. That was a sign to me that he was feeling better, for he'd been content to stay home during the past few days. Now, though, he was ready to catch up with whatever was going on in town. Probably at the Bluebird, which always buzzed with news. There was a large round table in the back where men retired from the daily grind generally congregated to speculate on the world situation and to pass around current local rumors.
You might think of getting a haircut, I suggested, since you'll be downtown anyway.
Sam laughed.
That's on my list. Lloyd, let's go do that. We might get in a little Christmas shopping, too. Then we'll have lunch at the Bluebird.
So off they went just as Mildred called, saying we had business to conduct. So off I went as well, but not before glancing at the want ads in the newspaper as I'd lately taken to doing.
Ida Lee, Mildred's highly competent housekeeper, or rather her general factotum, as Mildred called her, led me to the study. Mildred was sitting behind a large desk strewn with papers as a short, thin, fairly young man with a full head of curly hair and a fashionable hint of a beard was standing by.
Julia, Mildred said, looking up as I entered, come in. This is Tom LaSalle from Pearson, Hahn, and Everett in Atlanta. He knows everything there is to know about real estate. Tom, this is the other 50% of Great Dane Properties. Pull up a chair, Julia. Let's get this show on the road.
I soon learned that Tom LaSalle was whom you'd want to get a show moving right along. Edgy and almost abrupt in his movements and his words, Tom, as he urged us to call him, was one of those people who couldn't sit still. He was constantly on the move, twitching, doodling, frowning, smiling, talking, explaining, fiddling on his laptop, sitting down, getting up again. No wonder he was as skinny as a rail. But he knew his business and soon let us know it, too. But he'd have worn me out if I'd been around him much longer. He had both Mildred and me sign documents granting him authority to act for us in the purchase of the properties that we had our eyes on. From the sound of his report, though, he'd already assumed all the authority he needed. Jumping up to spread a map of the block on the desk, Tom LaSalle jabbed a finger at the Pickerel house. "Got this one. Already signed on the dotted line. Couldn't be happier."
"What did he say about the previous offer?" I asked. "I mean, was he hesitant about accepting ours?"
"First of all, he doesn't know it's your offer. Following Mrs. Allen's instructions," he said, nodding at Mildred, "I kept your involvement under wraps. The assumption is that I represent something similar to the Ridgetop Corporation." He twirled a pencil in his hand. "But no, no hesitation after I explained that Ridgetop was taking advantage. And they were, no doubt about it. Played on his fear that a group home next door would make his house unsaleable."
"What about Ms. Osborne?" Mildred asked.
He frowned, twitched his mouth, then said,
"Thought I'd have a problem there, but worked it out.
She signed too, but she was ready to sue Ridgetop for undervaluing her property. Had to point out the can of worms that would open up, delaying the sale of her property and so forth. No longer a problem."
"And the Winsteads?"
As quick as a flash, Mr. LaSalle revealed sparkling white teeth in a grin, then cut it off just as quickly.
"Had an ally there in Mrs. Winstead. She wanted to sell. He didn't, until I made him a high market value offer. He's happy now."
"How high a market value?" Mildred asked, not one to spend money carelessly.
"I'd done my homework. Knew what their property was worth, and so did he. Didn't overpay or underpay, which Ridgetop was trying to do. Now, ladies," Mr. LaSalle went on your authority, we'll close on the Pickerel property Tuesday morning, the other two that afternoon."
He began dealing out two piles of papers.
"Here are copies of the offers for purchase, the due diligence, a summary of the closing costs, and the amounts for each one. Sign and or initial where indicated. Already got a bank account open in the corporation's name with my name as the designated agent. I'll need the stated amount deposited by noon Monday. Any questions?"
"Is this all legal?"
I asked, having never before had anyone do all the work for me. Another flash of teeth.
"As legal as it gets. I'm using a local attorney as well, although I'm licensed in this state."
That relieved me until I wanted to know if it was Binky he was using. "Ms. Enlow Bates?"
"No. Mrs. Allen suggested the Carson Hanover firm on the basis that Ms. Enlow Bates is too closely associated with you. Two and two could be put together. My understanding was that you both wanted to remain anonymous. Was that incorrect?"
"No, that was correct," I said, wondering how I was going to explain to Binky our failure to use her.
Chapter 45. For the rest of the morning and into the afternoon, I was too restless to sit still, worrying over the fact that Mildred and I had committed ourselves to financial combat with Ridgetop Corporation. How would they respond to our sneak attack? And what would we do with three empty houses, none of which was the one we wanted? We still had time to call off Tom LaSalle and try another tactic. Should we do it? It was now or never. For once money changed hands, there'd be no turning back. After checking the want ads again to see if I'd missed anything, I walked into the library where Sam was resting with a cup of hot tea after his visit downtown.
"Sam, honey," I said, "how you feelin'?"
He cocked one eye at me.
"About as well as you'd expect with the head cold that's settling in my chest. But I've been waiting for you to settle down to tell you the latest from the Bluebird. There are some real doozies floating around town."
"Well, hold on for a minute. I need to ask you something first. You know I told you that Mildred and I have been thinking of what we could do to keep Hazel Marie's family from moving away. Remember that?"
"I thought you were thinking of what you could do to move the group home."
Same thing. Anyway, I said, taking a deep breath and plunging in, we've definitely decided to buy up everything on the block. Except the Pickens house, of course. Up went the eyebrows.
Uh-huh. And the Cockwood house, too?
Actually, we're hoping it'll fall in our lap when Ridgetop can't proceed with what they want to do, whatever that is. Anyway, I said again, nervously rubbing my arm, I'm feeling a little antsy about it. It's all of a sudden moving